I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Cinemas podcast. This week we will be discussing the psychological horror thriller It Comes at Night, as well as having an interview with the film's writer-director, Trey Edvard Schultz. Edward?
Just Edward, mate.
I don't know why I felt the need to say Edward. It's because Schultz is a slightly German-sounding name, so I immediately went Edvard.
Trey Edvard Schultz!
Willkommen!
Oh, it's because of Django Unchained, isn't he? Schultz.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Trey Edward Schultz, so we'll have an interview with him later on. But first, let's introduce who's joining us this week. I'm Sam Howlett, and joining me, a woman who only comes out at night. It's Jenna Hobbs.
Hello.
Hi.
That makes you sound like a lady of the night.
I didn't say that. Also joining us this week, a man so scared of the dark, he only comes out in the day. It's
true.
Jake Cunningham.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
Jake, why are you so scared of the dark?
Yeah.
What happened?
It's just that I got locked in the podcast booth for a night. Isn't there a horror film that you like where it's set at a radio station?
Yeah, it's called Pontypool.
Yeah.
And it's like a zombie outbreak, but entirely set in a radio station.
Yeah, based on my life.
That's why you're scared of the dark. Yeah. Excellent. So yeah, we will be discussing the film in all its detail. It's quite a spoiler-heavy film, so we will throw out a spoiler warning at some point for those of you who have not seen it, as there is much to discuss in the film's final act, and as well as the interview with the director himself. But before that, the opening pitch for this week. So the film is about a family who live in the forest after some sort of vaguely apocalyptic infection has ravaged the earth, and this family are alone in the woods and confronted with another family, and they wonder if they should trust them and help them, etc. So the pitch this week, guys, which non-horror character would you least like to show up at your door in an apocalyptic event? So a non-horror character that you think, oh god, it's this person, this is going to be horrible. JC,
okay.
Start with you.
Jakob Cunningham. Okay, well, I was thinking of people that you don't think of as horror characters that actually, when you think about it, are pretty horrible.
Okay.
Particularly, let's say you're at night and you're in bed, and let's say your bed kind of faces the door, and you just see the door handle open, and you kind of pull the sheets up. And I'm thinking about a character entrance as well.
Right.
And a character entrance that's well known and establishes the identity of a character going forward. Willy Wonka. Yeah.
Gene Wilder or Johnny Depp?
Gene Wilder.
Okay.
Always.
Yeah.
Would he like open the door and then do like the tumble?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he'd do. So, because that's really creepy. And as we all know, Gene Wilder did that so that we wouldn't know whether to trust him at all times, because he starts by walking like an old man and then does the tumble and then he's sprung up again. So you're in bed, you're trying to go to sleep, door opens, there, Willy Wonka, he hobbles in and then does a somersault and then springs up in your face.
Yes.
And then he flicks something, I don't know what, he's got magical powers, you know. And he changes the lights in your room, and then your bed has turned into the boat in the Chocolate River, and
going
you're in the tunnel. Yes. and he's doing that monologue that's just terrifying. And I think Willy Wonka is like he creates chocolate dreams, but you know, nightmares as well.
Well, he spends most of the film torturing children.
Yeah,
nearly drowning them, turning them blue.
If I'm not mistaken, Willy Wonka is the basis for the Jigsaw Killer.
I think so, yeah. He also, his silhouette is reminiscent of the Babadook.
Yes.
So imagine the door opening and it's a Babadook kiss.
Willy Wonka.
Yeah. Okay, very good. That's horrible. Jenna Hobbs.
Well, I think Jake's twisted it. I think this is a horror character now.
What, Willy Wonka?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you not seen Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Jake?
No, I've seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Of course.
Yeah. Right. So, I think I'm going to shock you here.
Can I shock you? I like red wine. Sorry, Jen, go on.
Right. Just getting back to my serious pitch. Mm. Stop laughing at me. Right, I think that... Jake, are you quite finished?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, I'm going with the most annoying character in film of all time for me. And I think this is going to shock you, because I think to have spoken to me and to have seen me, you would think, I'm going to like this film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
Mm. Is it something we share?
No, I love Cher.
Okay. Well, I thought that would be the shock.
No, it's going to be Elle Woods in Legally Blonde. Reese Witherspoon's character.
Ooh.
Okay. It's a post-apocalyptic world, and you've just got one person with you for the rest of time. Oh, my goodness. Could you imagine how annoying she would be? She'd be bending and snapping, and you'd just be like, pick up the wood, Elle, we need to make a fire. She'd just be like always right, but wrong. Like clearly wrong, but then always proving you right. She'd be like, I'm going to go downstairs and, you know, use up all our water. And you'd be like, why would you do that, Elle? And then all of a sudden you'll realise the water was the thing that was killing you. And, you know, she was right all along.
Also, what use is a lawyer when there is no more law?
Yeah.
Mm.
But in my head, it's like we've replaced the kid from The Road with her. The straight man in this is Viggo Mortensen.
Walking around a trolley full of stuff with Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah.
Is she always wearing her like blonde suit as well?
Oh, yeah. She's bright pink all the time. Right. And she always gets annoyed about chipping her nails, things like that. And this isn't against Reese Witherspoon. I love Reese. Mm-hmm. It's just...
Elle Woods.
The most annoying character ever.
Does she have a dog as well?
Oh, Bruiser. With the dog.
Is Bruiser still going?
Oh, Bruiser's still there. Oh. Useless. Oh.
What was the sequel to Legally Blonde?
It was when the dogs fell in love, like Legally Blonde 2 something.
Blonder.
Blonder. Legally
Back
Blonder.
In the habit.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. Another I don't have one. Much about the story other than I just wanted
like,
to share.
Apocalypse, you just hate that. It's just like annoying.
Oh.
So it's not really making it a horror character, it's more just making it an annoyance.
I've gone for an annoyance as well.
Yeah.
I've gone for Ruby Rod from The Fifth Element, who is Chris Tucker's character.
Oh, yeah.
A phenomenally annoying character. Not only is he incredibly annoying, he's also scared of everything, which is someone you really don't want to be with in a horror situation.
Mm.
And he's got that high-pitched squeal. Oh, he almost ruins that film, I think.
I mean,
I love the film, but God, he's a terrible character. And him showing up at your door, I think I'd rather just spend eternity alone than have Ruby Rod with me.
That's quite a statement. I didn't even get that far with Elle Woods.
So are you saying you'd murder him?
Well,
there's no law.
As Henry II said, who will rid me of this troublesome Ruby Rod? And then insinuate what you think that will mean yourself.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. He is really annoying.
Yeah.
I think The Fifth Element is fine. I don't love it that much. Mm. I would say Lilu would be horrible as well. She's pretty annoying. Yeah.
Gorimin Dalus.
Yeah, most people in that film would be really annoying to hang out with.
Ridiculously over the top. Yeah. I think maybe I've gone for an easy option, picking an annoying character rather than someone who's just like unsettling.
Rather than my vision of true terror.
Yeah. Well, when we talked about this earlier, as an example, I used Mrs. Brown. Like, imagine Mrs. Brown showing up. Hello there! But...
God.
Yeah, that's all Mrs. Brown does.
That's all she does.
Goes, says hello there in really annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Imagine that.
That'd be horrible. Just zombie. Ah, hello there. imagine the like basement scene in the road, but with Mrs. Brown instead of Viggo.
There are lots of characters that would be just useless in this situation. Like any Woody Allen character would just be frustrating beyond belief.
Yeah, I don't think he becomes a horror character at all.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, what would be a really bland one? Like Joaquin Phoenix's one in Irrational Man, like a philosophy teacher.
That would annoy me as well.
Yeah.
Pick up the firewood. But what does it mean to have firewood? I haven't seen Irrational Man. Okay, so should we take a vote?
Yeah, sure.
Well,
I'm going to go for Willy Wonka.
I know, but Jake only won a couple of weeks ago, and I feel like it's not fair. He might win overall.
No.
He's stacking up the points.
You can't vote tactically, Jen. You've just got to go for what you believe.
Or is it not an election?
Who are we trying to get in here?
Yeah, there's no grid that tells you if you want this person, vote for this person.
Yeah. All right, Jake won.
Well done, Jake. You met up with Trey Edvard Schultz, didn't you?
Yes, I did meet up with the hair.
Auf Wiedersehen. Trey Edward Schultz. And do you want to introduce this interview for us?
Yeah, Trey. Weirdly, I'd not met this guy before or listened to interviews. Mm. I'd read stuff. But for like weeks beforehand, this was like the most casual that I'd been approaching an interview. Because I just, for some reason in my head, it was just like, he's definitely just going to be a dude. Mm. I was just like, he's definitely cool. And this was even before I'd seen the film as well. It's like, I just got the feeling.
Is it because his name's Trey?
Yeah, there's something about Trey. I was like, that's a cool name. This is going to be a cool guy. And then when I was like prepping the questions, and then when I got in the room before the interview room, I was like, oh my God, I'm suddenly really nervous because I've just prepped the whole time thinking he's going to be really cool. I'm like, what if he's awful and this is a terrible interview? But then it was great and he was exactly as I hoped. And it's a really nice discussion. And I know he had kind of issues with how the film's been marketed in different territories. And he actually got into talking about that, which is something that I didn't expect. So there's some stuff, really interesting stuff. And he goes into a lot of the darker territory. We touch on some stuff that kind of is in the trailers, but maybe not necessarily in the films, and what you might be expecting from this film for those people that are listening that haven't maybe seen how it's been marketed. It's really good.
Excellent. So this is Trey Edward Schultz. Enjoy.
So we're delighted to welcome Trey Edward Schultz onto the Curzon Film Podcast.
Delighted to be here, man.
Excellent. So what I wanted to start with today to talk about It Comes at Night is the name, because it's just a wonderful name.
Thank you.
It's lovely. Oh, it invokes so much in just four little words.
I hope so. I love it.
Yeah. Well, who came up? Was that your name?
Yes. I came up with it, and I didn't think... I'm glad you love it. I think a lot of people, at least in the States, have been frustrated and hate the title and don't feel it's true to the movie. I guess that's why they hate it, because a lot of people thought it was going to be a monster movie or something. And I never thought about it that way, but it makes a lot of sense that they would expect that. But yeah.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. It almost feels like the tagline that would come on a 50s horror.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's great.
It comes at night.
That's great. Hell yeah.
Talking about the fact that people have been taking issue with not knowing what it is.
Yes.
Did you ever think about showing this, the outbreak that we have before Paul and his family are hiding?
No. Never had the slightest desire to.
Okay.
And it was always... part of it is just the storytelling I like. I like just being dropped into a story and going forward with the characters and figuring out stuff as it goes on. And then past that, it's like, how many damn movies have we seen that start with the outbreak and how it starts and sets up everything? So why do we need it again? But I don't know.
Yeah, because did you think, going into this, I want to do a Cabin in the Woods, or I want to do a take on a slasher or something?
No.
Take on a zombie.
And it wasn't, it was the opposite. It was just starting with the personal, and it's what this turned into. And I didn't even fully comprehend why it became what it was, if that makes sense. Yeah. So it was like, I lost someone I loved. I was in grief, and I started writing, and it started with the opening scene, which is taken almost word for word, probably from what happened in my life, and then spewed off into a totally fictional narrative. Now, in hindsight, I can psychoanalyze everything and see just how personal and intermeshed everything is, from the setting and visuals to relationships between characters and everything else. But after you do that and you have to like try to get a movie made and stuff, you have to like pitch it or something. And at that point I was like, yeah, it's like my version of a horror movie. And like, but I never approached it like that.
Okay.
It wasn't so much intellectual and like, I'm going to do my take on this thing. It was more just purely personal and see what it turned into.
Yeah. And that opening scene is really impressive for kind of grounding the film as to what we're going to stay in, just with these small group of people in this small location. It never feels like we need to learn exactly what happened at all. That's just a really lovely scene that feels absolutely heartbreaking, but horrible.
Thank you. That was the goal.
Yeah. So we're given this setup of this house in the woods and this family living there, and then we get the arrival of Will, Christopher Abbott, and that brings in the idea that I think runs throughout the film, and the thing that I took away from it is this discussion of kind of trust and faith.
Sure.
And that becomes a big issue in the film. And how do you see their relationships of trusting each other, the two families, develop throughout the course? And where did that come from for you?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Okay, where that came from, it's interesting. That was more like, I don't know. I was like reading books on genocide at the time when I wrote this, and I was just thinking about how like a group of people, just normal people, can do something terrible to another group of people. Like, I was really just like, surely that was fascinating to me. And then I don't, it just kind of spun into everything that it is. And for me, I approach it as like, I believe in every character in the movie, and I think they're all just people trying to do their best, and there's no bad guys or good guys. And like, I was fascinated by just putting all these people I kind of cared about in one house and seeing how that turned out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because we are with Paul and Travis and their family, but this could very easily be exactly the same film if we were in Will's perspective
totally.
And that's what I think is, that's the great subversion for me, is that I'm watching it and I do actually, I know we're given hints to mistrust people, but ultimately I did come out of it thinking I believe everything that everyone said,
that's
which is
awesome.
Not something for a horror film.
It's very true. Yeah. Well, but, and it was never approached as a straight horror movie, you know?
Yeah. Because they're all, I think there's something about how the fact that when they're brought down to their kind of primitive vulnerability, and ultimately they still mistrust other people, which I know part of it was, I don't know whether there was a political thing in there about that, ultimately they're still, people are still scared of sharing, and that, I think that comes in later on in the final act of the film.
Of course. I mean, I think that's 100% there, and I don't know. It scares me. People scare me.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know.
Yeah, because you really feel for everyone in it.
I hope so.
Now, looking at the visuals of the film, it's a very beautiful film. I wonder if you could tell us about the development that you took with Drew Daniels and Karen Murphy, the production designer?
Yes.
Building this house and the look of the film.
Love them. They're my collaborators, and they're amazing. It was a lot of stuff. It was so, like, first, just I guess visually, the first thing Drew and I talked about were like, it was how we wanted to feel night. And like a lot of, even a lot of horror movies and just movies in general have night lighting, you know, like it feel, it's like subtle movie lighting, but it's different from how night really feels. And I think the movie's sort of also about fear and sort of fear of the unknown and, you know, just the simple unknown of that black void around you when it's like just one little light and what's like, that scares me.
Oh yeah.
You know, so we really wanted to nail that. That was the first thing we always talked about. But then that leaked over to everything. There's so much, all the way to the film grammar and sort of like almost like the patience and subtlety we wanted with the camera a lot of the times, to like how we did our day interiors, and it had to have its own look because even there's boards on the windows. But then to like the production design aspect and everything, I had written bits and pieces of details of how I saw the house in the script a bit. Karen was fascinated by that and why, and what it was inspired by sort of my like part-time childhood home, which was my grandparents' house, which was a ranch in the middle of Texas called Pee Wee Acres. My grandfather was a prisoner of war from World War II, and he escaped and survived and went on to live a life. And my grandma always talked about how different he was, like the man before that war and the man after. Just how internal he was, and not a very emotional person, but on the walls in his house, it felt like it was his insides put up on the walls. You know, there were weapons from different centuries and decades, like swords and rifles and World War II paraphernalia. Yeah, like a Nazi Luger, and intermixed with family photos and Bruegel paintings. And it's like it captivated me as a kid, and there was always sort of a timeless quality to that house. And then to me, it just felt like the perfect way to tell this story and sort of what the story's about. And what I was referencing to when I was doing it was sort of, you know, it's like cycles of violence, and how we keep going in these loops. So to me, I wanted it to be sort of like a timeless house in that way, with different decades and periods sort of felt in it. And Karen, my production designer, just like, you know, helped us find this incredible house and just filled it with this world. And she's incredible. She did us a huge solid by, I think this is the smallest movie she's done. She was like supportive and passionate and amazing. And a lot of it, though, we didn't do a huge amount. Like the house is as is. We built the red door and the surrounding structure to it. And then she just brought the world, more of the world, to that house. But that house is really incredible.
And you mentioned the painting, which the Triumph of Death.
Yeah.
Which what I quite liked about the way that you present the painting is, often when there's a piece of art in a film, it's like meant to be, I don't know, referential or implicit. It will be kind of in the back of the shot, and you feel like, oh, I recognise that. Yeah. Whereas this is front and centre. And I really admired that. I thought that was great, because that's just telling people, go and look this up as well. Like,
yes.
Take note of what this is.
Yeah. I don't know. I think the one shot in the movie that's like the painting and then pans to the hallway and the family photos and the door at the end, almost like visually sums up what the movie's about in a way too. I don't know. It was important to me. I'm glad you dug it.
Yeah. We briefly touched on the camera. It's got this really interesting relationship with the characters.
Thank you.
It's like we, a lot of time in horror, even like thinking of The Shining, the camera often has this kind of floating omnipotence about it.
Yeah.
But with this film, it, like, there's a particular tie to the character of Travis.
Yes.
Which I really, really love. There's a particular moment where he looks to the side and the camera goes with him. And at that point, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whose head I was in.
That's so great, man. I love that. I know we approached it that I think this story is Travis's story. And the camera should feel like him, but almost not even always be literally subjective to his point of view, but sort of like convey his feeling, if that makes sense. And even if he's not around for certain scenes, like almost shoot it in the way he would feel it or perceive it, you know, and scan it. But yeah, thank you.
That's all right. I think Travis is a really wonderful creation. He's at this age, he's 17, is that right? Yeah, he's at this age where he's first kind of beginning to question his father's actions, yeah. And he's kind of exploring his sexuality as well.
Yeah.
So in some way, do you think, kind of see this as a coming of age film?
Yeah, in a very twisted way.
Yeah.
in a very twisted way, yes. And to me, you know, he was always the gateway to the story, and it had to be through his eyes. And I just, I don't know, I feel for this poor kid. He's good. He's like, he should be chasing girls in high school. He shouldn't be dealing with some of the heaviest stuff that he could be dealing with.
Mm-hmm. And now there's been, we mentioned the release of the film in America and the reaction there.
Yeah.
There's been a lot made about how the film has been marketed,
yeah.
And it's been, perhaps looking at the trailer, more of a choppy slasher home invasion.
Yeah.
What's your take on that? Do you think that means more people will see it, or?
It's hard. I will say I think I'm more at peace with it now, because I'll drive myself crazy if I'm not. But you know, it was just really frustrating to me. It's frustrating to put so much of yourself into something and then have it go into the world in sort of the wrong way. And it's frustrating to see certainly the wrong audience getting suckered in and just hating the movie. And then it's like, that sucks. And even past that, I hope that people that would have seen the movie don't see it because of what the trailer is. But what keeps my spirits up are when, you know, either people just love it or they see it and they're like, it's not what I thought it'd be or expected, and it's mismarketed or something, but I dug it,
yeah.
You know, and it makes them think. And I don't know. It's weird to be in the middle of it. And I, for me, I just hope it reaches the people it's meant to reach. And I wasn't in control of the marketing. Yeah. It was never designed to be a mass consumption movie. And, you know, so it's crazy. Like in the States, we have a huge wide release, which is insane to me. But hey, I don't know. Still figuring it out.
Yeah. Because there's even shots in the trailer that don't appear.
That aren't in the movie, right?
Yeah.
And
we, there was a lot of fuss made up about that happening in Rogue One. But that made me curious to think how much of this film was shaped in the edit of it.
Not as much as you would think. The biggest thing, there was a balancing of just sort of tonal between nightmares and reality and getting that to a place I really dug. And then the biggest thing was, like, I did have an end, like a final big nightmare confrontation, where, you know, I think these nightmares that happen throughout the movie, for me, they're a way of, like, sort of accessing this kid's subconscious, you know, and visually representing what's going on in his head, whether that's the fear of this disease or grief over his grandpa or this beautiful new woman in the house and how twisted that can be in these circumstances, or this weird guy, like, whatever. I don't want to spoil everything, but they're him sort of confronting his subconscious and his surroundings in these nightmares. And I had written a final confrontational nightmare where he has to contend with everything his parents have done,
okay.
Where he essentially goes to hell in his world, if that
is
makes sense.
Fire?
That's the fire. That's why,
yeah,
you see,
yeah,
the fire. We literally burnt down a set. some amazing performances that I cut, but it was just too much. And it was like, yeah, it was like the last 5 minutes were just insane, just like bah, bah, bah. And intellectually I could justify it a million ways and had like a lot I was trying to say into it, but no one, I would show it to people and no one would get any of that. They'd just be like, holy shit, chill out, what are,
yeah,
you doing? So that was tough, and I edited alone forever, and I didn't know what to do at the end, and I brought on another editor, and then we just went further down the rabbit hole and we didn't know what to do. And then one day we were picture locked and everything. One day I like had an epiphany, and then I started like just playing with a ways. I was like, is there a way to say everything I want to say and get across what I want to get across without the fireworks? Mm-hmm. And I started playing around, and I was like, this feels great. You might have to unpicture lock.
Yeah.
And I convinced everyone, and everyone was very supportive, but you know, it's nutty. I just finished the movie like a month ago, and now it's already coming out. But I'm happy with where things wound up and how it turned out. I'm proud of it.
Yeah, I mean, you gave us what will probably be one of the most bleak final shots of the year.
I love that.
Well, man, thanks you so much.
Thank
for
you,
us.
Brother.
It's been great. Cheers.
It was great, man. Thanks. Cheers.
Okay, so the first I ever heard of this film was when I saw the poster months ago. I think A24 announced it on Twitter that their next film would be this horror film, It Comes at Night, and the poster's incredible.
The dog.
It's the dog barking at something in the distance in the forest, and just the title, it's kind of like the four words are getting bigger as they come down the page, and it really reveals nothing at all. So going in, I had like sort of minimal expectations. I really didn't know what to think. And
you had read stuff about avoiding
trailers. Yeah, I'd read to avoid trailers and reading into it at all. So enjoy this podcast. but I think it's a 90-minute just unrelenting, grueling, punishing sort of anxiety fest.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what you want from a horror film.
Yeah. I'm not a well-established horror guy. And so I read stuff online afterwards with people complaining, like, it's not even scary. Like, the same thing, like, people had with The Witch and It Follows and Babadook. And I would, like, I think this is scarier than those films.
Yeah.
But this was nerve shredding. I had a horrible experience watching that, in this in the best way possible, like covering my eyes moments, because it's like really intense but in such a different way, because there's actually quite a lot of space to it. Like when it goes out into the woods, it's so it's like intense the way that everything, it's like you're used to a feeling of claustrophobia in these things, but the house itself has a real, like, it's touched on in the interview how they had to work around the fact that everything was boarded up, but there's a lot of space in the house but not much natural light, and it's a really strange atmosphere that's created, and that makes that unease which you feel from the first moment for 90 minutes.
I don't think I've ever been so anxious in the cinema. I just, honestly, the entire 90 minutes just felt like something awful is going to happen at all times. You never felt like, oh, this is a safe bit.
Oh, I think there's like a 2-minute bit where it's like a family bonding bit.
Yeah.
And that's your one moment of relief, which is about 50 minutes in, maybe.
Yeah, when Travis is talking to Riley Keel's character, and they joke about him not liking cookies. That's the one sort of relief, I think. The rest of it's just, like, it's a cliche, but you are sitting at the edge of your seat. Your palms are very sweaty.
You'll pay for the whole seat, but you'll only need the edge.
Oh, God. So let's break down some of the cast. So probably the biggest name in it is Joel Edgerton, who, for me, has become a really impressive but underrated actor.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
He's kind of quiet. He's not completely emotive all the time. He's quite restrained in everything he does. And I think he could have been sort of pinholed as one of these kind of, like, sort of Sam Worthington, Jai Courtney, Jason Clarke, Patrick Wilson types, who are very much tall brunette guys that aren't particularly, you know, there's nothing particularly special about them. They just kind of, they do the job in certain films every now and then.
Yeah, it was, what was it, like,
was it a boxing film or a wrestling?
Warrior kind of broke him out, yeah. And he was in Animal Kingdom as well. He's Australian. So yeah, I think he could have just kind of blended into that kind of crowd, but I really think he's come into his own in things like The Gift, and even in things that I'm not a huge fan of, like Midnight Special and Black Mass. I think he's incredible in both those films.
Yeah, and, stuff like, and he's making really interesting choices, like Loving yeah. as well. He's definitely. Really choosing his role. Yeah. I don't think he could be a huge mega star if he wanted to be, but he's picking roles that clearly mean something to him.
Yeah, and he's an executive producer on this, so I think he's sort of choosing his own opportunities and creating things for himself, yeah. which is really good to see.
And he's got like went into directing The Gift, yeah. and it's like we haven't really heard much about what's going to be. It's not like he directed The Gift and then has gone straight into becoming a director.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he's gone on to take his producer role here, but also an actor, and he's kind of dipping his toe into lots of different things, but seems to be doing well in all of them.
Yeah, and in this, I think he's. Both times you kind of feel safe with him when he's on screen. You feel safe for everyone around him because he is this kind of, you know, tough family man.
Meets Ray Mears.
Yeah, the sort of survival expert of sorts. But then there's this kind of darkness to him. And I've heard people compare him to 1980s Kurt Russell in this film. His sort of hairy, manly. But I think there's something slightly more unhinged about him at times in this film.
Yeah, I don't think he's at all like comforting.
No,
I didn't trust him really. I thought there were some moments where I thought, okay, he's an okay dude, but there were bits like the way that he had a plan for everything, and that everything had already the routine of this survival was so ingrained in him, like it immediately seemed a bit. Untrustworthy, a bit like non-human.
He sort of lost his humanity,
yeah.
So dedicated to surviving.
Exactly.
Yeah. It annoyed me how patriarchal it was, and how he had to be the leader, and he made every single decision,
yeah.
even though actually most of the times they didn't necessarily seem like the wrong decision, but also not really the right decision either.
Yeah.
But I think this is what the film's playing on. There's a lot of grey areas to do with trust and truth, and like the orders and trying to. Like what happens when you deviate in a survival situation,
And we'll get into all those trust issues later on. So I guess
sorry, that sounds like Frasier. We'll
get into
those
trust issues later on. another notable actor in the film is Christopher Abbott, who you may know from Girls. He plays Charlie in Girls.
He does indeed, Sam.
Yeah. And he's another character who you're not sure if we can trust him, if everything he says is believable throughout the film. What did you make of him in this? Because obviously, Jen, you're a big Girls fan.
I am a big Girls fan.
Was it distracting to have Charlie suddenly rock up?
I didn't recognise him in the initial scene, and it wasn't until...
they took the bag off his head.
Yeah. I mean, he had a bandana to start with.
Can I shock you?
You guys are ganging up on me today.
Sorry, it's because we're recording at night rather than... We're normally used to a morning slot. We haven't quite woken up.
I know.
Because Jen only comes out at night, so we can only record after 6 today. Are you okay,
Jen?
Oh,
yeah, because it's so dark outside. It's 6 at the summer solstice weekend.
Oh, dear. Anyway... I've lost my train of
thought. Christopher Abbott.
Christopher Abbott. I didn't necessarily recognise him to begin with, potentially because he had a bag over his head.
Who is that?
I recognise those shoulders.
Now, from Girls, you could recognise all sorts of people's bodies from that. So I could have recognised his shoulders. yes, I thought he was great, actually. I wasn't expecting to see him in a film like this. It's obviously very different from Girls, but he's a great actor, and I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah, well, he kind of went away from Girls, didn't he? Because I think in seasons 1 and 2, he's this quite light character. He's almost seen as sort of overly sensitive. And then he goes away, and when he comes back in Girls in season 5, he's a much darker,
he's got a lot more
dramatic
secrets.
yeah, and he's bringing that to this role, I think, really.
Definitely.
Well,
I never really got along with him in Girls. I always found him annoying, even from the early seasons or the darkened version. I was like, either way, you're still irritating. But this, he managed to shed that, and that I think that intensity that he was trying to bring in the later bits of Girls actually works here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because he's meant to be, like, they're both meant to be straight-edged, family men.
Yeah.
And that is believable, and that kind of that intensity that comes with being a driven father in that situation, and the way that that boils over, is very believable with both him and Joel Edgerton.
Definitely, yeah. So those are the big names in the film, I guess. But for me, the heart and soul of this film was Kelvin Harrison Jr. as Travis, who yes. is Joel Edgerton's son. And I think it's his film, in a way, which surprised me. I mean, he's not a clear main character, but I think he's the one who you kind of identify with most.
Yeah, he's kind of felt told through his eyes, yeah. most of it.
Yeah, and there's a couple of dream sequences, and he seems to be the only character who has those dreams mm-hmm.
yeah,
that
I think,
we follow.
Because at the start of the film, we're not in his perspective.
No.
We're objective. We're looking... I think we can say how the film begins.
Yeah.
With the family killing Travis's grandfather, Sarah, Joel Edgerton's wife, her father. Like, literally, you see he's infected. It's close up on his face. It's really hard to watch this conversation between them all. And it's just... I think there's some awareness that he knows what's kind of going on,
yeah.
and they're basically just taking him out to the woods, shooting him through the head and setting him on fire. And then we kind of like we all see that objectively, and maybe about 10 minutes of kind of just establishing what this world is, maybe. And then we get into a dream sequence from Travis, and that's where the shift becomes, and then that it pivots to and from this kind of look at the family life and the drama there for maybe 15-20 minutes, and then you'll get 5-10 minutes of dream from Travis. And I think there's maybe what, 3 or 4 of those?
Yeah, a handful of dreams. Yeah. So we're very much we're asked to identify with Travis. Mm. And I think that really helps. It's nice to have this character as the kind of vessel for us because he's kind of naive, he's innocent, he's seemingly very kind, quite sensitive. But then an incident happens that I think does throw you off. And this film does that a lot. You think you trust this character, and then something will happen. Like it will either be just one throwaway line or one certain look that will make you think, ooh, I don't know about this anymore. I don't know if this is the character that I'm supposed to identify with and I'm supposed to trust. But it's an amazing breakout role for him to carry this film.
Yeah.
And I know it's a short film, but it's such an sort of intense film.
Yeah. We shouldn't forget the women in it.
Yeah,
as well.
Of course.
Riley Keough. Yeah. Who people recognise from American Honey from last year. And
oh, that's what she was in. Mm. Yeah. Yes.
And so she
plays... Very different role, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Rabbit's wife and the father of... what's the son?
Andrew, yeah.
Their son. And so these two families come together.
Yeah.
And she... And again, but like I think Riley Keough is, I think, less... Has been less broken by this world.
She seems to have some kind of optimism still left
in
her.
I think that's because she's got her son to cling to, and he's so young, and she is almost able to protect him from how awful everything is by being okay.
And so we should really introduce the other family.
Yeah, and then there's Carmen Ejogo as Sarah, who mentioned earlier, who you will recognise from Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. She's the head of the New York Ministry of Magic. I can't remember what that was called.
Oh, what is that called?
Oh, I should know.
Oh, you're the big Harry Potter person, aren't you?
She was also in Alien Covenant as well.
I think she
was Billy Crudup's wife.
Oh, man.
I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was in there. So she's had a good year. She's very good as well, but she's comparing her to Riley Keough's character. She's far more broken.
Yeah.
And far more sort of everything is by the book. You have these rules and you stick to these rules in this new world. There's no time for her for sort of sensitivity or what's the word I'm looking for? Sentimentality.
Yeah, I mean, she's very much her husband's wife.
Yeah, she's become this sort of survivalist character.
Yeah.
And that's it for the cast, really. It's pretty much down to these two families clashing. And essentially takes place almost entirely in this one house, which I think is really well handled. You never feel like, I mean, the claustrophobia is there, but you don't feel the need to kind of, you don't feel like you're bored of this one location, because it's such a, it's quite a big labyrinthine house. It's hard to work out the layer of it in the same way that in The Shining it's impossible to work out the structure of the hotel, because the camera is doing it's so close up on certain things and so wide in other places, and that really creates this feeling of unease really well. So I think that there's something to be said about the horror in the film and the film as a horror film. So you said you found it really scary, but there aren't monsters, there aren't villains, there isn't anything particularly like supernatural. So what is it that you found so scary?
I think that it's the dread. Mm-hmm. The fact that I think early on we see Christopher Abbott is captured by Joel Edgerton, and it's revealed that he comes from a house mm-hmm. a few miles away, and they're going to go there and trade water for animals, and along the way they bump into two other men who shoot at them, and Joel Edgerton is so quick to shoot these men that you don't know if they're infected or anything, and Abbott is beating the other guy, and then Edgerton eventually shoots him as well. And I think in that moment you understand his fear, like just how terrible the world must be outside of it, that you don't even take a second chance to think whether or not there is another human being, that the risk is so high that you would just instantly shoot someone point blank on the chance that they are not a regular person. And from there you're just constantly have that fear that these people do of what it is that's out there.
I think for me, kind of bouncing off what Jake said, the scariest part of it was not being able to trust or be totally honest with anyone ever. And once you lose that between people, anything can happen, as this film proves as it comes to its conclusion. And just the thought that you can't trust the person that you would sit down and share a drink with, and one, like, for half an hour of one evening they're your best friend ever, and then the next minute you're plotting to kill them.
Absolutely. I think this is really interesting in the sense of this kind of tradition in horror films. So in kind of horror films pre-1960, the horror comes from outside. It's aliens, it's monsters, it's like Dracula coming from Europe. It's these external things coming in. Whereas after, sort of, so you get Psycho, Rosemary's Baby, and things like Night of the Living Dead, where the horror comes from within the family, within the house, and sort of psychologically and physically, it's internal and it's from within. And in this film, It Comes at Night, the horror isn't from the infected people. It's not from any kind of zombie or anything. The infected actually play quite a small role in the plot of the film, essentially.
The screen time of anyone with the infection.
Well, less than a minute. One person.
Yeah.
You only see infected. The horror comes from the family unit and the destructivity of, like Jen is saying, about trust within the family. And that's really well handled, to have, to create and incite fear and horror without having a horror character per se, or a horror, particular strong horror element.
I think it's really just boiling down to the fact that you remove all social constructs, and immediately people don't trust people. And there's a line like mentioned later on about that Joel Edgerton talks about having to share things, and how good of a thing that is, that people can share, and that we can have water and they can have food and we can work together on that. And that lasts for about 5 minutes before it's like, that's mine, they're going to steal our stuff. And that parasite of paranoia, when you're kind of left by yourself to fend, and you've got no government, you've got no work or anything, and when people are just reduced to their basic instinct.
There's no law, so there's no L Woods to help you here.
She's not there.
Okay, so I think a lot of people are going to compare this to things like The Road, which you mentioned earlier, and to, for me, I thought of a film we actually discussed on the podcast ages ago, The Survivalist. It's quite similar to that in a way, and even to last year's 10 Cloverfield Lane. I still have been locked in somewhere during some kind of event.
And that flip-flopping of trust.
Yeah, but I think this handles it in such a way that really does sort of ring true this feeling of mistrust and this horror of paranoia and anxiety in a really delicate way. And it's only 90 minutes. And we talk about length, film length quite a lot on the podcast, but I think this is no scene is wasted, no shot is wasted here.
No, and there's something that I really wanted to... It's shot beautifully. It looks absolutely amazing. Some of the, just like the tree shots.
Yeah.
They're the best shots of trees you'll see since Twin Peaks. But what...
Smell those trees.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Something that annoys me in a lot of films is fades. A transition where, to me, a fade can be excellent, but used sparingly. It feels like a lot of the time it feels like sloppy editing, in that it's just like we can't figure out how to bunch these scenes together.
Let's
so what would
merge
is,
them?
Yeah, and that's it. And it feels like it feels lazy.
Yeah,
and there are two fades in this film that are so good that actually they're really thinking about the editing and they're thinking about how one scene blends to the other and how they can actually find meaning in the way that scenes move between themselves.
Is it the house in the middle of the screen that becomes just the trees?
Yeah, yeah. There's a shot from the woods that then returns, like it fades through to a point of view from the house of the same tree but in a different angle, and then there's another one where it fades to from the woods into Travis through a window with this kind of boxed in window. I don't know what that, when you have iron cladding, that's kind of like a cage on the window. But it was just those two moments, and it's not like normally people say with editing it's not something you should notice, but it was just these two moments because it just felt so satisfying to see something that's often done so lazily done so well.
Excellent. So do go and see It Comes at Night, and once you do, come back because we're now going to go full spoiler territory here. Talk about things that happened in the last sort of 10-15 minutes of the film, because there was much to discuss. So there is no it.
I think there is an it.
What's the it?
Oh, I don't know. It's whatever brought the dog back.
I think it's... I don't know what it is. I think, like, I don't know whether the infection... the it is the nightmares.
Right.
That Travis has. And that's what happens at night. And I think the nightmares are the first symptom of the infection.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Andrew, the little kid, is found in the other bedroom from sleepwalking as well. Because Andrew...
Another nightmare.
Yeah. And so they say that Andrew's never sleptwalked before.
Yeah.
And then he starts sleepwalking. And we know that Travis is sleepwalking as well. So I think... that's what it is.
Okay. The infection's really interesting because we have no idea what it is, what it does to you, how you get it or anything. It's not introduced to us at all. It's just there. So it seems like there's a lot of vomiting blood, which is really nice to watch.
Blisters,
black eyes. And they're not zombies or anything. It's not like it turns them violent like in 28 Days Later or anything. It's not really clear what fully happens to an infected body.
I thought it just sort of slowly killed them.
Right.
And then obviously it's really highly contagious and taking the rest of them down.
So the film leaves you with a lot of questions. The big one, I think, is
who opened
the door and who brought the dog back?
What's happened to the dog? Why did it run off in the woods? What did it see?
Who infected the dog and then brought it back? Or the dog came back, but how did the dog get in? Yeah.
Well, guys, it's time to talk about one of my favourite topics. So aspect ratios is what we need to talk about.
Here we go.
All right. He's taking his headphones off because I've already told him this. So when we're in reality in the film, we have our screen is like 16:9, like normal aspect ratio that we'd be used to. And then when we go into Travis's dreams, the screen actually becomes widescreen. So it's black bars at the top and bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we can differentiate between reality and dreams in the first kind of three times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But in the last kind of 10-15 minutes of the film, it's widescreen the whole time. It's letterboxed the whole time.
Oh, so you think that...
I think at that point, the dreams and reality for Travis are completely blurred and he's got no idea when he's awake or not. And that's why there's so much confusion. Because he, I think he undid it. Like, cause there's that dream that we see where he goes out and he hears the dog, he goes out at night with the gun, and so I think that's when the door is opened.
Okay.
And he brings the dog back in. The dog is killed by something or bitten by something. Right. Travis brings the dog in. The dog has an infection as well. And then, so I think that is when, like, it gets brought into the house.
Mm.
Although, like, Travis, I think, already has it anyway.
Okay.
Okay, that makes sense. I wasn't sure if the dog had an infection. I think that Joel Edgerton was just, like, overcautious and overzealous, and he would just
kill the dog, like, regardless. I don't know if it's essential that the dog does have it.
Okay.
I think the dog could almost be a red herring in that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just that Travis is the one that's gone out and left the door open when he's come back in after bringing the dog, mm-hmm. after dreaming about it. But that's actually reality.
Okay.
And then he's gone and found Andrew sleepwalking.
Yeah.
As well.
Okay. Definitely an option.
So really, that means that the door being open has nothing to do with anything.
Because
they were already...
They're already infected.
Yeah.
Do you think they're all infected from the beginning?
I think Travis...
Because they're being around the granddad.
Well, if you notice, there are two beds in Travis's room.
Yeah, so he was sharing...
Oh.
And
perhaps
the dog is mentioned to be the granddad's dog.
But then... Travis says that he found
Andrew in granddad's room.
Yeah.
But if the dog is the granddad's,
yeah.
If the dog can get infected, which Joel Edgerton believes, and they would have evidence probably from previous experience that animals can pass the infection on. So if the dog is the granddad's, and then the dog sleeps in the same room, as Travis, is at some point the dog lick Travis's face?
Maybe.
Possibly.
I don't know, but I think...
It's a lovely dog, though, isn't it?
But yeah, I think Travis is infected from the beginning.
Okay.
And that's what the dreams are. That is... There is no proof for that, and I asked Trey after the interview if he knew who opened the door.
Yeah.
And he said he did, and he wouldn't tell me.
Ooh!
Well, it's obviously Will that opens the door, guys.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe.
Who's
Will is Christopher Abbott. Because... Sorry. You trust Christopher Abbott. I don't trust Christopher Abbott because he says that he was living with his brother.
Yes.
And then later on, he mentions that he's an only child. And Joel Edgerton brings him up on this. It's kind of a little throwaway line. He says, oh, you said you were living with your brother. And he says, oh, yeah, well, my wife's brother. I considered him my brother. There's got to be a reason they have that dialogue in, I think. Unless it is a red herring to make me want to...
I think this is full of red herrings.
This is full of red herrings.
And the reason that I don't believe that is... I think it betrays the message of the film, because I think this film is something that's underlying throughout is that you can believe everything that anyone says.
Mm.
If you trust everything in this film, ultimately people are still going to try and kill each other.
Mm.
And I think that's the scariest thing, that you could tell each other the truth about everything.
Yeah.
And so that's why I choose to believe in Christopher Abbott, because ultimately it makes the film scary.
Yeah, that's a good point. But there's that line, and there's also the bit when he first takes Christopher Abbott to go back to his house, and the two guys appear and try and sort of ambush them. And he says, you walked 50 miles and didn't see a soul. We've left our house for a minute and two people have already appeared. Maybe he's in cahoots with some people. And that's why he's so adamant that they not kill this other guy. As well,
potentially,
and maybe Will open the door to get something going, to get something started, so that he could eventually take over the house and take over their water supply and this nice setup they've got, which clearly works.
But then they're trying to leave, aren't they? Or are they not trying to leave?
Maybe they're not trying to leave. Maybe they're trying to meet these other people that they know they're out there because someone infected the dog. If the dog is infected,
yeah, but the dog can be infected by another animal.
That's true.
But we don't ever see Andrew either to see if he looks
He's completely
infected.
Hidden by his mum, yeah.
Yeah. And they keep saying, cover your eyes. Why else would you do that other than being infected?
Or because he didn't want Andrew to see them with a gun threatening to kill people.
Just to kind of keep Andrew safe and innocent.
Mm.
There are no answers. We're not going to get anywhere.
That's why it's good, because the unknown is so much scarier.
Yeah.
And that's what this film so relies on.
I mean, there's things as well, like how long has this been going on for? Like, when did this outbreak start?
Yeah, actually, this made me think that...
it's kind of timeless.
You could have an It Comes at Night cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Because, like, in the way that World War Z didn't, but World War Z, the book, is a collection of little stories in different places at different times during a zombie outbreak. And this is just one little story about this outbreak.
That's like an enhanced view on one little part of this worldwide apocalyptic event.
And, like, imagine maybe a office situation as well, and like this infection takes over some office.
That's
kind of like Belko experiment stuff. But you could have so many different places and really weave the horror of it.
Any other thoughts about some unexplored parts of the film that you had some theories about, or anything left still wide open? I mean, do you think that is Travis definitely infected at the end, or is it another dream?
He's definitely infected.
He's definitely infected.
Yeah, well, because he infects the other two.
And they just sort of look at each other over the table and he's gone.
That last shot is horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, like they know that that's it for them.
Yeah. That is something that I can't remember if it's in the interview or not. I think it might have been afterwards.
Okay.
But the final shot of the film was not normally the final cut of the film. There was a whole other scene and this, like, he actually had a final cut and they had picture locked it, as he puts it, that it was done, and then he kind of just had a moment and was just like, no, we have to take it out, we have to bring it back again. And then so at the time of the interview, he'd actually only finished what became this cut that we've seen a month ago.
Wow.
And with that new final shot, which is maybe the like one of the best bits of the whole thing, because it's
it barely stays in it as well, doesn't it? It's just
also, it's ambiguous, is it? Are they sitting there knowing that they've caught this and their son's gone and they don't have anything left to live for? Or are they sitting there thinking, can we kill our son to keep us safe?
You don't know what order it's, the events have happened.
I think they've, like, they're sitting there knowing that they've just shot their son through the head.
Do you think? I think it's either or, isn't it?
It's either or.
I think
a lot of that film, I think they were so worried about keeping Travis safe. Like, don't, like, when he got so mad at him for running off into the woods. Like, and in those situations, what have you got to live for? Your children, and keeping your children safe. So I wondered, it could be either. You could be right. They've shot him through the head because they want to save themselves, or they've realised they've got nothing left to live for anymore.
No, I think they're both infected as well. Like, I think you look at their eyes. Like, it's not quite quick because they were, like, having a fight. Like Chris Rabbit beats him up or something.
Yeah.
But for me, like, it could be a trick of the screen that I was in, but as soon as I saw it, it was just, oh, they're both infected.
I did think about the mum's eyes, but I wasn't sure if it was clear or not. I couldn't guarantee that I've definitely seen it. I wasn't sure. I think Travis is still alive by the end of the film, because I think we're so aligned with him that the film won't finish until he's dead. So I think that's just before they're about to kill him, that final shot. And then when the film ends, that means that the next thing they do is kill him.
Right.
I feel like we're only watching the film as long as Travis is alive.
That's a really interesting point. It's just because we're shown the shot of the dining table, and that we're opposite Travis during that. And so for me, his vacancy is vacancy from life.
Yeah.
I think this film needs another watch with a pen and paper.
A watch pen and paper and another hour to go into it.
Well, I turned to you at the end of the film and I was like, Sam, is it finished or is there another part?
Because it's really nice to talk about a small film like this and like to get really into it, like people do with something like Inception.
Yeah, or a Marvel film or a Star Wars film. We're talking about it as if it's got this rich, full history.
Yeah.
Which it feels like there is.
Mm.
Yeah.
It feels like such a full world.
Yeah. Okay, so that was It Comes at Night, but it's not the only film you can watch this week. Jenna, what do you recommend we could watch this weekend on Curzon Home Cinema?
A few weeks ago, Jake, Helen and I spoke about Seasons in Quancy, 4 Portraits of John Berger, and that is still on Curzon Home Cinema and well worth a watch, and you can go back and listen to us talk about that. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. And just on a Joel Edgerton horror hype, his directorial debut that we mentioned earlier, The Gift, is on Curzon Home Cinema. And that's really nice for kind of the house of The Gift. Made me think of this house as well, in the kind of like the openness of it. Like this one's all boarded up, but in The Gift it's so full of windows and it's so
light.
Yeah,
there are no walls, there's just windows. It's really modern. Yeah.
And a lot of The Gift happens in the day as well.
Yeah.
So it just, it plays on a lot of the tropes of horror. It's actually, it's really good fun.
It's another film about trust as well, and who can you trust? Who is the trustworthy character? Yeah. Who's the villain? It plays around with those ideas.
And it's a different Joel Edgerton role as well.
Yeah. Yeah, you haven't seen that before.
You've never seen
him like this before. The Edgerton of your seat.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. So that is the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to CSR for letting us use their studio once again. And that's goodbye from Jenna.
Bye.
Goodbye from Jake.
Bye-bye.
We will see you next week. Thanks for listening. Can I shock you?
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.